Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Michelle Rabagliati panel. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's about it.
All right. Yes. All right. And actually, this is a very exciting show because he is debuting his new book, Paul Joins the Scouts, at the Conundrum Press table downstairs. And so I was one of the first people to read it. And
it's the first time I see it myself.
See, tell me what you think. I was completely blown away by it. I'm actually not sure I'm going to be able to talk about it without spoiling it. But I think...
Pretty well printed at the ticking.
Oh, good, yeah. let me start off by asking the audience a question. Are you familiar with Michelle's books? Have you read his books before? So we don't need to go through the whole who is he thing. So this is good. Okay, good. It's good to, always good to know your audience. Okay, so let's just jump right in. Why don't you... start by telling us, this is the easiest question, why don't you tell us about the book?
Okay, first of all, thank you for coming, thank you for being here, and excuse my poor English, I'm really bad, so...
it's better than my French.
So this is the seventh one in French, it's called, what's it called in French, Paul au Parc. But we couldn't translate it in English. Paul at the Park didn't sound really good. So we said Paul Joins the Scouts. It's about the action goes on in the 70s during the FLQ events. I don't know if you know that the FLQ events in Quebec. We had a bunch of terrorists in the, during the 60s, and they blew up some mailboxes and postal shops and things like that, and people were getting a little bit nervous about that. And that's what it's in the background. It's not a story about the FLQ movement. It's just that it's in the background, and things are going on. When Paul goes into a store, you can read the newspaper behind, talking about the event, talking about the FLQ, the terrorist events. But most of all, it's a story about it's a story about youth. So Paul in that book is 10 years old, and he's kind of bored during this summer of 70. Doesn't know what to do, and he runs out into two guys. He runs into two of his friends, class friends who are in the Scouts. And he decides to join the Scouts in this particular summer. So that's the main story. But of course, in my books, you always have a lot of little stories all over, satellite stories, I call them. So it's about family. In that book in particular, you see more of Paul's family on his father's side. So you see his great aunt, his grandmother, who are French, from Paris, and my mother is having a rough time with her mother in there.
Mm. Yeah, now you just blew it. You said my mother. Referring to Paul in the third person. can you talk a little bit about how much is this is fiction and how much is autobiography?
It's about always about 80% true and 20% fiction. So I don't I don't care about doing really. Completely true story. It's not important for me. What I want is that the reader has a good time reading my story, and that he gets some surprises, I want him to have fun, you know. So it doesn't matter for me if everything is 100% true, but I need that at least 75%.
Something to structure.
Yeah, because if I go on from scratch and I do fiction only, I don't get the energy to run the story. I need some true facts to start the story.
So you were in the Scouts and your grandmother was next to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All these are right. Are true.
And you're. Well,
when I lie in my book, there are some lies, but you can't really point them out because they're plausible. So it's
they're plausible.
So did that word exist in English too? Plausible. So and I usually lie on the chronology of the events. What I do is usually is that I gather a lot of small events and I try to do a story with that. But I move the chronology. Sometimes this scene happened 2 years before the other one, but it doesn't matter for me. I want to do a good story, so I put put them all together. So it's interesting for a reader.
Do you find Do you find it, I know when I write nonfiction, this is sometimes an issue for me. Do you sometimes have trouble figuring out what to leave out when you're working from, when you're doing a memoir?
Well, I leave out all the insignificant details, like, you know, just looking out the window and doing a peanut butter toast, and that's not interesting.
You don't ever, like, get halfway through something and go, oh, there's too much, I have to throw something out?
Well, yeah, usually I have too much stuff, or some events are similar, so I have to choose. But usually what preoccupies me is to have a good story and really catch the reader from the beginning at the end of my fishing pole, and I don't want him to go away. I don't know if it works in that book in particular, but I'm waiting for the comments. I didn't have any comments or reviews about that one, but from what I hear from my previous book, I think it works. I think my scenarios
Well, I was actually late coming down here. Thank God the panel started late. Let's just put it that way. Because I was like, I got to finish this book.
Okay.
So, one. If you had like a time machine and you could go back and hand a copy of this to your 10-year-old self, what do you think that this, would he get it? Or do you think that your writing in this book reflects an evolution of thought in the intervening
years? Do you mean if it's written for a 10-year-old boy? Or?
No, not so much that as, do you think you would, does this reflect the way that you look at the world now, or the way that you looked at the world when you were 10?
When I was 10, this is a view of what I was looking at when I was 10, and what I was living at that time. Because if I was to tell a story about the FLQ, I wouldn't take this tone. So when I talk about the FLQ in that book, it's only a boy looking at the TV, and just his eyes are only running through the covers of the newspaper, but he's not really aware of what's going on. He's not really aware of the serious of the business with this terrorist movement. So it's all from a boy's view, from a 10-year-old's view.
Another thing that struck me too was some of the subject matter, in that you were writing with obvious affection and unironicness about Catholicism runs through the whole story, as just kind of like an element that's always there.
What's Catholicism?
Catholics.
Oh, Catholics! Catholicism, yes. Well, when you talk about scouts in Quebec...
I didn't know you had to be Catholic to be a scout.
Yeah. Wow. In these years, yeah. The church was all behind that. You know, the Friday night reunions were all at the church sous-sol, basements, and they provided the space and the camps too. When we went to camp, it was the Jesuit or the Marist, or they were all Catholic organizations.
Yeah.
That's why we could have these camps for really nothing. I don't know if it cost something to be in the Boy Scouts in these years, maybe $50 a year, but it was really, really cheap for the parents. But it's because of the church. The church had all the grounds and the lakes and the campsites for us free, so that's why you hear about Catholicism a lot. And the Scout movement is based on, the Baden-Powell movement is a Catholic movement too. We did some prayers and each morning and everything. So and we had the priest with us each week.
Yeah.
So it was with us each week. Each Friday night we had our pastor with us. But they weren't so assommant with that. They didn't bother us really much with God and everything. It was just a matter of making us think about nature and friendship and sharing. That was all okay with me and my parents too.
It's just interesting because now I think there's so much dialogue, and the Catholic Church has become very controversial. Scouting has become very controversial. So it was interesting to me that you could write about these from the point of view of a child and actually not bring any of that in.
Yeah, some people that read my book, they're waiting. I mean, they think that in this book there's something's going
to
happen, like a sex scandal or something, because you have men who are sharing their time with kids, and everybody was...
Is this a spoiler? I'm sorry.
No. But none of this is happening in this book. But I hear it from people who read my book.
Yeah.
They said at one point I thought that the counselor was going to jump on him or something. No. But No, so these guys were really fantastic, and I had a great time.
They sound great. You sound like you had a great childhood.
Absolutely, but I had a great time in Scouts. This book, you know, the Scouts of Canada liked it so much that I did the calendar this year
The
Scouts of Canada. Yes, they printed like a million copies, so it went really well for the calendar. So they like this book, and they like the positive image that I give in this book, because everyone now is like a bit, you know, spitting on the Scouts and all. Right. Oh, you're in this, you can't be in the Boy Scouts, you're kidding. So it's not, it's really it's becoming a corny movement. They have a problem with their image right now.
Yeah. Well, this will help a lot.
Everybody thinks it's a paramilitary movement, but it's not. That's not like that.
It comes off as just the opposite in this book, which is very interesting. And one of the interesting things to me, too, was the way that you varied the point of view. So most of the book is told through Paul's point of view, but then we get these little vignettes of the other characters. Why did you do that? Why did you break the point of view?
I made that at the end. At the last minute, my girlfriend told me, you should talk about the counselors. Uh-huh. The counselors. You should make a small capsules on these guys so that we can know who they are outside of the Scouts. And this is, I think it works okay. And you can even see that one of the counselors is an homosexual. He's gay. Yeah. But you don't feel it when he's with the guys. But in his real life, he has a boyfriend. So that's maybe why people were waiting for something to happen, but nothing happens.
Yeah, they actually deal with the issue in that little sequence, which is pretty cool.
I kind of, you know, I clamp it, and I say it once and for all.
Can you talk a little bit about your drawing technique? Do you do this using old media, or do
I use an old-fashioned technique. It's like really at la Hergé, you know, Hergé, Tintin. So it's like in three sequences, three steps. What preoccupies me more is the story. To be honest with you, I don't start drawing until I have a good story in hand. So I write down some ideas in a little like this on a little notebook, and I think about my story during months and months and months, and I take notes, and then I start doing some synopsis and some sketches but only writing. And then when I have my story, when I have my synopsis finished, then I start doing the découpage, the sort of storyboard.
Thumbnails. Storyboard.
A storyboard, but I don't write down the dialogues. I leave that for the storyboard directly. So the fun part is really the storyboarding. That's cool, because you have this written story only, and you have to do something with drawings, dialogues, narration, mise en scène, you know, angles, camera angles, all of that. So all of that is done once at the same time. So it's a pretty cool step.
So that's interesting, because one thing that I was noticing is that you do a lot of visual storytelling starting right on the first page.
I use like cinematographic effects sometimes. Yeah, this is sort of a préambule. You don't know what it's about. It's just a running shoe hanging from a tree with smoke behind it. And I just leave the reader with that in total.
And then on the first page too, you kind of do something similar. It's almost like manga. Do you read manga?
No, I don't read manga.
Oh.
Should I?
Yeah. Everyone should read manga. And read my blog, mangablog.net.
Oh, you're a manga expert.
Manga blogger. No, but I
know that.
But this is almost like a classic manga technique. But it's also a cinematic technique.
It's a classic cinema technique. I don't invent anything here.
So do you work that out in the storyboard then?
I see that in the storyboard. But sometimes I add these things at the end to put, I don't know, just to make an more interesting story. So this préambule takes, I call them like, I call this technique a tulip bulb. So you plant it at the fall, and then at spring you have to get a tulip at the end.
Yes.
So this is the tulip bulb.
Oh,
and at the end you'll get
dropped on that. Oh my God. Yes.
You'll get an explanation at the end.
Yes, you do. Okay.
And it's a black and white technique, ordinary. I use a brush to do the what's in front. The close-ups are done with a small brush. And it's about the same size. I draw about the same size, so 9 by 12. This is 8.5 by 11, so it's almost the same size. And then when the inking is done, I have to go on the computer, unfortunately. I hate computers now, but I have to do it. In that particular book, my daughter did the gray shades for that
book. Oh, really?
That's good. It was her summer job last summer. $10 an hour.
Oh,
not so bad, eh?
But
it really helped me because I was so tired at the end of the summer, and she was really good. And she took Photoshop. I just gave her a couple of Photoshop lessons.
How old is she?
She's 18.
Oh, okay. And how about, do you do your own lettering?
Yeah, I do the lettering, yes. I do it. Not in English. I think it's done with a font that's done with my lettering. I gave my sample of my handwriting to Conundrum Press, and then they had a font done with that, and they write with it. But sometimes when you have big typography like this big one here, I have to do it. I do it myself.
Oh, okay. So you do the sound effects.
Speaking
in manga too, actually.
Yes, you have to do it because it doesn't look right, you know, with ordinary just machine type blown up.
So do you translate your work? I'm sorry, I didn't look at the title page.
No, it's Elga. I have the same translator from the... I've been working with her for 15 years now. Elga Dasher, she's from Montreal. She's a very... She knows all about the Québécois français. So
uh-huh.
She speaks the same... And she speaks French Québécois, and she's very good in English. And she was born in Germany. But she's very, very good. She knows all the, you know, the jokes and the Québécisms and riddles and everything we say in Québécois. She knows about that. But she has a lot of obstacles in my book because, you know, you have songs in there, jokes, riddles, and
there's a pun.
Word games.
Everybody's like making not understanding FLQ in French.
No.
And so rendering that into English must have been a challenge.
Yeah, she has really sometimes she has really big obstacles, and she can't do anything with it. She just has to translate it.
Do you work with her, or do you just
work
the English version at the end?
No, I work with her. She can call me. I mean, she doesn't live far from my house. It's really fun doing the English translation. After that, other publishers use my English version to. Let's say Astiberi in Spain, they use the English one.
Oh, they do the translation.
They don't start with the Québécois one. It's
right.
Too hard. They would have too much trouble with that. They're better to go from the English one. You know, all the Québécisms the traps are taken care of.
Yeah. So it sounds like, can you talk a little bit about your process? It sounds like you don't necessarily do the book from page one to the end.
Oh, yes, I do.
You do?
I do, yeah. I'm pretty serious. I'm pretty a square guy for that. So I start with page one up to, you know, page 150. I don't know in that one. Maybe it's 120 or something. And I have to see my story all finished. I want to read it a couple of times, maybe 10 times, just to make sure everything's okay. And then when it's okay, I do the first leading, penciling, from page 1 to page 120, and then inking. The inking is really the boring part of bande dessinée for me. There's nothing really interesting in inking. You just want to make it cool and reproducible and nice for the printer, but there's no creativity at that point.
Well, you have an interesting line, though.
Yeah.
You vary the line quite a bit.
Yeah, it's fun to do, but at that point, I just listen to music and try to think of something else. It's so boring. But it's kind of nice to see the finished pages, and you can add little, you know, touches, and it's cool. Of course, you get finished pages, and it's nicer than only pencil for me. But that's about it. I work in a really classical fashion, so three steps, and that's it. Computerized, computer grays at the end.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't like to color it. It's not important for me. Color is not important. I could do it.
Yeah.
My publisher is we would be glad. If I probably would sell a little bit.
So why wouldn't you? Do you think the black and white is important?
It's okay.
I mean,
when I'm finished with this, I work like it's 2 years of my time. So yeah. For one book, if I have to colorize all this, I would have to pass, I don't know, 6 or 8 months colorizing this. Yeah. And I would be feeling like just doing like, coloring books. It's not interesting for me. It doesn't add anything
to the
story.
Don't say that in front of the colorists. Colorists.
Oh, I'm sorry for you. For me, it's not important. It wouldn't add anything to the stories. Would it be better? No, I don't think so.
Well, that's the most important question.
Yeah. For my style anyway, for my style it would be better. I'm more a storyteller than a draftsman. You know, it's my drawings aren't really spectacular and they're just efficient. Like let's say I don't know Hergé has got a nice style too, but he was aiming for efficiency and fluidity
right.
of reading. He wasn't drawing to to make a show. It was just he was doing things just for the kids to understand very well what's going on, and that's why you can't let a Tintin down because it's so captivating.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Yeah.
Because of the mise-en-scène, which is so, tight in chronometry.
So, now I understand you were a graphic designer.
Yes, I used
this.
To be a typographer, and then I went into graphic design.
How has that, do you think it has helped you or hurt you, maybe? How does that influence your comics work?
Oh, it influenced. It's funny because this style I have here that's done by hand, it comes from my computer design, my computer illustrations. I used to work only on Illustrator, or in fact, I worked on freehand, which is similar to Illustrator. But I used to do only computer illustration in the 80s and in the 90s. So when I decided to do comics, I had to work by hand. I was fed up with computers anyway. I just wanted to, take a piece of paper and draw something in black on it. And relax. So you can feel maybe the neatness or the cleanness of the computer in there. Maybe in my line, because I used to work very nicely and cleanly for my computer's illustration. So my influences mostly come from a guy called Sasek. I don't know if you know Sasek. He's a guy, he's a Miroslav Sasek. He used to do books. Maybe you saw these books. This is New York, this is London, this is Paris. Big book that Casterman used to publish in the 60s. Touristic book for children. They used to send this guy, let's say, to Venice. And he, from his hotel room, he did a reportage, a drawn reportage of the city. And he drew in, and he wrote the text too, all the redaction and all the design. But he did that in his hotel room. in the city he was talking about. So he's probably my main influence. Yeah.
Really?
This guy, yeah. He used a really hard edge line, no black lines around the characters, really 60-ish, cubist a bit, influenced by the cubists.
It's you have a little interesting separate self-referential moment in this book where the character Paul finds a book on how to draw comics. And I thought your reaction to that book was really interesting. What did Paul say about it? You tell him.
When it's as teachers, the reaction you say because it's
no, well, Paul's reaction in the beginning when he looks at it and he goes, "It's not just like how to draw a dog with cubes and circles." I could never figure out how to draw a dog with cubes and circles. And I have an MFA, but I still can't draw. But
yeah, sometimes you see books in stores like how to draw a cat, how to draw a all you have to do is draw a cube and two triangles on the top, and you have a cat head.
How does that work exactly?
I'm not good at that. But when I saw this book, was quite a revolution in the 60s. It was published by Marabout, but the author is Franquin. Franquin is the drawer and author of Spirou, which is a big character. And you have Tintin and you have Spirou under it. And you have Gaston Lagaffe too, which is a famous character in Belgium. So Franquin, for me, was a god. And he published this book with Marabout, and he was talking about all his techniques you could. So in this book, Comment devenir créateur de bande dessinée, it was called, How to Become Comic Artist. It was the only book available. I never, you know, for in that kind of book, I never saw another kind of book like that. And I really read it, you know, 100 times. I went to my school library and I took it again and I rented it again just to have it at home as long as I can. And I learned a lot of tricks in there. So you can see that guy Franquin draw, because you know when you were a kid, you don't know, you're not sure how they're made, these comics. Are they big like that? Are the heads big? How do they draw there? How can they do that? These wonderful black lines. Do they? What tools do they use? So in that book, I had all these answers. You know, you could see him draw with a brush, and then all you see is you could see his pencilings, and you could see that he works on pages like half pages big like that. And he talked about the comic market too. How much you can get paid for a pay? How much you could get paid for a page, and how the business went on. It was really an interesting book. It has been republished today by Nifl in France, but it was out of the market for 30 years. So this was like an important book for me.
And in the books, I'm just checking the time to make sure we have time for questions. It's really funny because your character, Paul, then tries to draw some comics.
Yeah. You have two frames that he's trying to draw some comics. It's pretty cute because he thinks that... This book really excites him, so he decides to go at the art store and get some material to start his own comic. He thinks he has all the elements in hand to do comics, so he knows how to draw characters, whatever type, yelling and everything. So he puts everything in the same frame here. It's all messed up, but he draws everything he knows in the same frame. So that's the kind of mistake you do when you're young. You put all the action in one frame, and everybody's talking and yelling. So he shows that to his father, and you know he has a little drop coming down his forehead. He's a little bit. He doesn't know what to say about it. So that's pretty cool. And he does a couple of tries like that in the book. And he's at a point he gets discouraged and he doesn't know what's wrong. He says, "My God, I do everything. You know, what does he say exactly? I don't get it. But it's done on the game." Okay, so, you know, he does this kind of picturing, and his father, he's asking, "I don't get it. How come the boat's in the air? No, they're underwater, Dad. Look, they're wearing masks." "Of course they are, Robert," the mother's trying to remember. "Oh, forget it." But it's totally, and Paul, he says to himself, "But it's totally obvious that they're scuba diving. What's the goddamn problem?" He doesn't know how to carry a story and, you know, how to make it clear for the reader, so everything's in the frame. That's the kind of mistake I was always doing when I was a kid.
So I was just wondering if you had, like, pulled those out of your old notebooks.
No, I pulled them out of my head, but they're pretty similar to the characters I drew when I was a kid. To make it really amateur, I drew all this with the left hand, you know, to make sure it's really trembling a bit. So that's it. Oh yeah, and there's something interesting in the book. Franquin says that if you want to. What quality do you need if you want to be a good artist? First you have to have fun. Then you need to keep being a kid in a way. I think having a certain childlike quality is essential. So he says to himself, "Hey, I'm a kid already, so it's going to be even more easier for me." He's not grabbing exactly what he's talking about being a kid.
What was the hardest part about this for you? What was the biggest challenge in this book?
What's the biggest challenge in this one? I had to be like a bit. There's something happening in there at the end, you know.
Yes, there's
something.
Big,
there's a big
spoil it.
Turning point, And I didn't want to because these people still exist and still are alive. And the thing is, I had to mix the cards and change the names and change the where the action takes on, not to frustrate or just by respect for these people,
yeah.
You know. Yeah. And you have to read the book once yeah. to see the story. But there's some kind of knot here that I had to undo. That was a problem in that one. Another problem? No, there's no problem of a no major problem. I had a really lot of fun going back to the scouting, you know, and trying to figure out what songs we were singing at that age. And Paul's learning the guitar. This is all true, you know. I learned guitar from my counselor. And you know, today I really this is what was really beneficial for me, because now I play piano, because I play accordion, I sing in choirs, but it's because of that guy. He really initiated me to music, and he gave me a couple of guitar lessons, and that was it. You know, I was really hooked up. And I did the same thing to my nephew. That's funny, because I gave him a couple of guitar lessons, and now he's playing in bars, and he's a jazz expert and everything. It's incredible.
So this is what, your eighth or maybe seventh, we're not really sure, number of graphic novels, a lot.
It's the seventh. I'm doing the eighth.
How are you, like... Has it now become a routine for you? Is it easier than the first one, or is it the same every time?
No,
just
it's
open
not
a vein.
It's
start
not open a vein. You mean the open vein like this? Well, each time it's a different artwork for me. That's why there's no numbers on the book. You know, they're not number. It's not the one number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I like to change the age of the character. This is probably the last time I'll talk about the childhood of Paul. The next one, I'm doing Paul at Black Lake. He's 16 years old, and this will probably end up the buckle, the round up all the child story from Paul. In the future, I'll probably be talking about him when he's 40 and up. So yes, each time it's different. This book is like I always consider a story like a block of rock that I have to chisel and see what's in there, you know. So each story is different, and I want to have fun. I want to have interest. So I'm not just piling up stories. This would be too boring.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. So then the day I don't have anything more to say, I think I'll just leave. I just stop. You know. I don't want to. It's not like a series for me. It's like a end of career gift. I'm not 80 years old, but I used to do like illustration and graphic design and everything. So this is like a gift for me. I'm really having a good time. I can do whatever I want, the length I want, in the time span. I can do whatever I want. So it's really really cool, and I'm making a living on it. So it's doubly cool. But I'm always looking at a project with serious, and if I don't have anything to say, I just wait. And when I think I have a good story to share with the reader, then I go ahead and do it.
Very good. Does anybody have any questions?
Yes.
I was a scout too, and I for a couple of years. So this is very. It's great to read this stuff. It's really bringing back some memories.
Okay. Did you read it? You had to check?
I've read about the first three pages.
Okay. So you just got it.
So far, I just got it.
I think they just got it.
But I'd be curious to hear more about sort of how you feel about seeing your work translated into English over the last couple of years. Like, I'm an Anglophone from, you know, the Midwestern Canada originally. One of the things that I love about this stuff, about your work in particular, is how rooted it is in... the Quebec culture.
Yeah, you can feel that.
I've learned a tremendous amount just about kind of the culture at the level of kind of like what it was like, you know, because you know the big things of, you know, the history of Canada, but not just like the little details, the folk singer, like it's, how do you feel about kind of the stuff going into English? Like,
I'm really proud of that, and I think my translator is doing the best job she can with that. I'm aware that she has a lot of obstacles. When I give her the final French, you know, she's really like, "Oh my God, we have a big problem here, and there." But I'm not doing this for her. It's for the French public. But I'm really glad about what she's doing in there. And the Quebecois fact and all these little things about Quebec, I'm hoping that Canadian Anglos and Canadians and people from Belgium and France are appreciating that. And I hear that they are. You know, they're you have a good social portrait about the contemporary Quebec in here. I think when somebody reads my all my books, they get a good portrait about what's going on in Quebec right now. How do we deal in two family matters? How do we deal with kids? And I think it's pretty exact. The cultural portrait is pretty exact.
Although I also have to say, because we're almost the same age, that it also...
You're 25 too?
Yes. thank you. Your book gets a good review. It also rang very true in terms of, like, I mean, I grew up in Indiana, you caught the tenor of the times very well. And it's, like, interesting because, like, the Catholicism that you grew up with is, like, what I grew up with, uh-huh. which is what's so different from what's now. And the way that people talked about things and thought about things, I was never a scout. Actually, I was a Boy Scout. They had some co-ed thing for a couple of years, but I didn't go out in the woods. I don't do that. But, you know, I think that it's interesting because... Your book is interesting because it is so particular in that it has those many details and, like, the little storefronts and the titles on the books. There's a real richness to that. And at the same time, I think there's a real universal quality to
exactly.
it that anybody
that's,
can
that,
get.
Exactly. That's what this is becoming because, yeah, when I don't do ordinary storefronts or it's storefront that exists in Montreal. And I think that gives a nice flavor to the story. And everybody can appreciate that. When I draw the St. Catherine Street, I mean, it's the good one. And you have the real panels, and some are in French, some are in English. When the story goes on in the 60s, you have more English signalization, and that's what it used to be.
Yeah.
In the 60s, everything was English, and then in the 70s and in the 80s, some of the English panel signalization began to go out, and there was the law 101 and with the law 101 now all the owners are obligated to have French signalization outside their storefronts. So you can feel these changes in my books. Yes.
I'm so looking forward to reading this book, Michelle. My father's in the military, and I moved to the South Shores in San Bruno in 1970.
Ah, San Bruno.
And I was going to an English Protestant school. The FLQ was threatening to attack the schools, and we had soldiers on the corners. And I was 15, and this was like
you remember that
moving to another planet.
Yeah.
Very, very strange.
Everybody was kind of nervous, you know, and my parents didn't know who these guys were, so they said they were maniacs and don't go out at night. And after the events in the 70s, they showed things about, they talked about the FLQ, and you could see that it was a small movement. In fact, it was just a bunch of guys, you know. Yeah.
As I recall from being 15 years old.
So yeah.
I'm very much looking forward to seeing your perspective on it.
Uh-huh.
I did have a question too. That nothing is bad. I just looked up the Creative Club on this day, and I noticed that it was written by Franquin and Giget.
Yeah, Giget.
Two very different approaches.
Yeah, I didn't talk about Giget, but Franquin was the real vedette for me, the real star in there. But they're both in that book. Franquin and Giget, yes. But Giget's style didn't really appeal to me. In fact, it was really nice, but I was a big fan of Gaston and the style of Franquin, which was more, 60-ish and really nervous and everything.
Mm-hmm. I think we have a question over here.
I was just curious, is it just a summer job for your daughter, or is she also interested in the arts?
Yeah, I think she is interested in the art, but she doesn't want to admit it.
Yes, you should forbid her from doing it. Yeah. That's the best.
But I'm always saying, you're an artist, you don't know it, but I do know it. She's a good writer, she's good in drawing, and she has that sensibility, and she's, you know, she should be in the arts, but maybe because I'm taking so much place in the house, you know, being an artist and everything, and there's drawing all over the place, she doesn't want, you know, to try
maybe
it for
because
herself.
She's 18 and you're a parent.
Yeah, that's one thing for sure. But now she's working in a fruit shop for the summer. But she's still interested in doing the gray shades for the next one. So maybe that will be her next summer job. I don't know.
You always also, direct her toward the coloring if you decide to go that route.
Yeah, the coloring. Yeah, that could be fun for her. Yeah.
Don't give her money. Just make her do it.
No, tell her she can't do it.
You can't do it.
No. Coloring is terrible.
She'd be good at that too, but you know how they are.
Yeah. I got one at home. I know.
Okay, you got one.
Any other questions? Yes. Yes, Tina.
So since your work is partially autobiographical, when you're going through something, do you know this will be a story someday? And then how long does it take for you to get away from that?
No, because sometimes I live day by day, and I feel, this could be interesting in the future, and sometimes it is, and sometimes it just vanishes from my head, and it wasn't interesting. But I really have to, wait like 5 or 6 years before I can, like the Song of Roland. It's just the story about my father-in-law who died in 2003, and I waited like 5 years before starting to write about him. It was really warm in my heart, and it was really a story that I really liked to tell. That was all the events were in me, and I really had a great time to telling that story. But sometimes it doesn't happen. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what's going to be my next story after the next one I'm doing. That's always the problem.
So when dramatic things are happening in your life, you're not taking notes?
Well, I'm not taking notes. I don't need to take notes because, my mother died last August, and I don't know if I'm going to talk about that because I already did a story about death and cancer and everything. But I'm not ready anyway. Yeah. It's too fresh. Maybe I'll talk about it in 5 or 6 years in another matter than the Song of Roland, of course. I wouldn't want to do the same book and the same story. But I would like to talk about my mother. It's too fresh for me in my memory right now. I'm probably going to do a portrait of her, but maybe in 5 years.
Mm-hmm. We'll be looking forward to it. Any more questions? All right, well, thank you all for coming. And thank you.